Hello everyone and welcome to Non-League Keeper, a podcast dedicated to the goalkeepers of non-league football. And we're joined today by a member of the England management team, that's the England C team, Mick Payne, goalkeeper coach. Mick, first of all, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Well, it's always a pleasure, Rich, to come on and talk about the England C setup and my career, really. So, yeah, looking forward to it.
How are you finding the current situation, particularly with COVID?
Well, as I said, I think like everybody, Richard, it's been a difficult time. It's been a challenging time. And strangely enough, a bit like goalkeeping, really. You know, things are set to try you, you know, and it's the way you deal with it. And I think if you can deal with it in a positive way, in a confident way, then you get through it. So it's been a tough encounter for many people indeed. But as I say, you just got to roll with it and try to do your best, I think.
I know when we spoke earlier in the week when we were sorting out times, what have you, you mentioned about doing a lot of BBC coverage. So how has that been affected with the current situation?
Yeah, it's been a bit of a problem. I mean, people do realise that, you know, or perhaps don't realise, local BBC radio has not been, you're not been allowed to travel. So that's been a real problem. And, you know, I've worked for BBC Lancashire, Manchester, Cumbria, and also BBC London. But unfortunately, they've been curtailed at the moment. But the nice thing I've been doing quite a lot of games over at Dagenham Redbridge. I've been doing their sort of their live stream. And there's been good coverage on those because, you know, the opposition sort of have to tune in on for the live stream if they want to see their games, you know, like Chesterfield they had the other week, Stockport, Grimsby in the Cup a little while ago. So it's good, you know, so keeping my sort of things in place, really, still doing me live football, yeah.
It's important to go and like watch live football. I know on a Saturday I always feel like the Saturdays always seem to go a bit longer because I'm that used to going out covering games myself or, you know, even just going and watching them. So it's very important to get out and continue doing what you love doing.
Oh, without doubt. As I said, it's been a godsend, to be honest. You know, we're lucky people. There's no doubt about that. You know, that we can go and see some live action. You know, there's no one in the ground, which has been, you know, again, I say to people, it's a strange environment to be in when you're in a stadium with no one in it. I mean, the guy I do the, I'm the summariser and the commentator, but we say there's three of us in this stand over the far side at Dagenham. There's me, him, and a wheelie bin. So it's quite funny, really. This the wheelie bin gets a good chance to see what's going on as well.
What's the atmosphere like at the behind closed door game? Because I haven't actually experienced one myself personally. I'm assuming many of our listeners haven't either. So just talk us through what it's like compared to this time last year when fans could go.
Yeah, you're right, Richard. You know, people are not privileged to come into a game, which I feel for the supporters of the clubs, you know, lots of community clubs that, you know, rely on their supporters. Now, the atmosphere is a very, very, very strange indeed. It's eerie at times. As I said, there's no one in the ground other than the players and perhaps one or two other sort of media people. But the one big thing I think has come out of it is you can, when you're there, your communication that the players bring, you know, you can really hear the communication that goes on, the encouragement, also the, I wouldn't say back chat, but the things that are said to one another. It's quite an interesting sort of format that you perhaps don't always appreciate when there's fans in the stadium. But the other thing I maintain so much is certain players are, I wouldn't say reveling in not having fans there, but they're not under pressure. The fans are not there, but there's other players that need fans there to get them going, or teams need their fans there to get them going at certain times in a game. So, yeah, no fans there for me is we've got to get them back, hopefully, sooner than later.
I guess on the flip side, you were just talking about the play. You can hear everything the players can say. The players could then hear what the media is saying, and I guess that might affect how a player performs.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, I don't know if they're really concentrating on what we're saying too much in terms of, you know, when we're there, because there's not many in the stadium, as you say. But yeah, it could have an effect. But it is. I just think, you know, the stage of certain in games, you need the fans. You know, I think we've seen it right across the board, you know, from the Premiership all the way down, the effect it's had not having fans in, because it's, as I say, you know, one of the biggest positions that have not been affected with not having fans in is the goalkeeping position. You know, when you're in goal there, you can hear every word usually from behind the goal. Well, now not being anyone there has made it a bit of an easy sort of task for the keepers at the minute. So they've not had to deal with that.
Yeah, I spoke to Cameron Mason and Matt Irwin of Curzon Ashton and Chorley respectively, and they both mentioned how strange it feels, you know, not having the fans behind the goal. So as you say, that plays a massive influence on the game. Just moving on to one of your other current roles, the England seating. For anyone listening in to this podcast and have never heard of England seating, just explain what the England seating is all about.
Yeah, well, Richard, as I said, I've been involved with the England C set up for the last, coming up for nearly 17 years now. You know, incredibly, done over 100 internationals. The England C team is an under 23 age group team, and it's from National League players down, right down the Premier League, you know, from National League down to National League North, National League South, and below that as well. You know, you can be the Northern Prem, you can be the Isthmian League, depending if you've got the ability, of course. I mean, I would say predominantly the players we do select from is the National League and the North and South, usually. But one or two players do come, you know, lower down. But, yeah, it's an under-23 side. And it's usually those guys who are selected. When we play, you know, we are playing against other countries that they don't have the pyramid like us in England. And we're playing usually their full international under-23 sides, or their under-21 sides. Sometimes they're B teams. But, we play some really big hitters in terms of our opposition.
You mentioned about it being under-23s. Was that a decision you consciously took at the start, or your predecessors, or was it just something that was forced on you with your various tournaments that have been involved?
Well, that's a good point, Richard. You know, it's a very valid point. When we first started out, it was the National Game 11, and it became the non-league 11, and, you know, the FA. So what happened, Paul Fairclough, who's the manager of the side, it was in terms of a development side, you know, it's a development team that gave, you know, it's great that you can give international caps to players, but, you know, sometimes it was being given to players who were at the end of their career, and it's a bit of an honour to say, you know, you've been around the league for a long time. We wanted this team to be a side that is, lads, as I said, under 23. I mean, we do select lads sometimes in 18, 19 who are on their way up. And, yeah, it gives them the opportunity to move on afterwards. When the England C side, and they get selected for the England C team, what tends to happen, it rubber stamps their ability, if you like, you know, in terms of who we've had in the England C side. You know, like Andre Gray, who scored the other night for Watford, he played for us. You've got Sam Clucas playing, you know, in the Premiership. You know, you've had George Boyd playing. You know, there's so many. James Norwood, who playing at Ipswich. Ethan Pinnock playing at Brentford. You know, Steve Morrison going back in the day. He played for us. Finished up playing for Wales. And you've also got Kiefer Moore, who is now, you know, playing his trade at Cardiff, who's a full Welsh international now. So it does give these players, you know, because it's an under-23 side, a real chance to move on up into the leagues afterwards. And they're an international player. It's as simple as that.
Do you think you'll ever go back to playing the any age player, or do you think it's now the route is under-23s football for England C team?
Well, I believe it's I think the, you know, when you really look at the cold light of day, to be an under-23 side, I think it's important. As I go back to what I've just alluded to, because it's under-23, they then get the chance, you know, if they're going to go into the Football League, that the scouts that come to our games and see them, they realise they've still got a number of years in them. You know, we go back when I was first involved, yeah, we had one or two players who were, as I say, they were, I wouldn't say coming to the end of their career, but they were older guys. And perhaps didn't have the chance to move back into the professional game. So we believe that's it's the right way to go and it's the right route. Yeah, we do believe that.
And just talk us through how a player will get selected from obviously the first call up to playing in the game and like all the training and meet up in between.
Yeah, so again, I'm really. Well, is it? You know, they're playing for England. It's as simple as that. They're getting their international cap. They will be scouted. You know, when there's a game coming up. Unfortunately, we've not had a game for a number of months. Like a lot of the England sort of younger sides, they've not had game because of COVID. We all know that. But so what we there's a scouting sort of system that goes to all the games. They're then reported on in terms of their performances. We keep a database of all these lads. We get recommendations as well. And then once there's a game sort of earmarked, we then look at who we believe are the right players. I mean, as I said, once some of these players only played one game for England C, because once they move back into the professional game, they're not allowed to be selected because they're in the professional game as such. But, so there's a lot of things go on behind the scenes, Richard. And, you know, as I said, there's this database there. We look at all their performances. And then we then tend to select a squad of sort of 16 or 18, depending, with a contingency squad as well of another 12 players. And then it's, you know, they get called up and hopefully get selected, yeah.
Once they get the call up and they're in the squad, just talk us through what the camp's like, and particularly in that lead up to the game, because I guess you only have a short amount of time in the lead up.
I mean, what tends to happen, usually the games are on a Tuesday night. So what will happen, Richard, is that depending where we are, whether we're playing away or playing at home, we tend to try to meet up. If we're playing away and we've got to travel, we tend to meet up on a Saturday evening, and that's after all the lads have played in their games, usually on a Saturday, and they'll all meet up together, and then we'll either fly out on that Sunday morning to various sort of venues, and then the game, once we fly out, or you know, if it's a home game, when we get there on a Sunday, we tend to do a sort of a cool down period, you know, because they've played on the Saturday. We do a little bit of, you know, light training, very light indeed, just to get the cobwebs out of their system. And then really the Monday is like a double session. And when we say a double session, it's a double session. I mean, we've already got a fair idea how we're going to line up anyway. And, you know, the starting lineup is already sort of penciled in, really. And then we go through. Yeah, and what happens, Rich, we, you know, usually on that Monday, we have that, you know, double training session where we go through the pattern of play, how we want to play, you know, where we're going to try to play through the thirds, or we're going to play with, you know, wing backs, or we're going to, you know, try to play with a press or whatever. So we go through a number of things like that, and then tend to do the same again on the afternoon session where it's a bit more, I wouldn't say vigorous, but play with a bit more tempo to it. So that's what happens there. And then usually on the morning of the game, we'll, you know, after we've had up breakfast and things like that, we tend to, if it's an evening game, which tends to be most of the time, we'll go through the set plays on the Tuesday morning, and then back to the hotel, bit of rest time, pre-match, that type of thing. Again, going through things on the... on the overhead whiteboard, and you know, just going through a number of sort of not things that are issues, but just making sure that everyone's clear. Because I think what sometimes people don't realise, Rich, when you're coaching players, it's really vital that some people learn differently to others. Certain players learn differently, and what I mean by that, some people need to see the information, some people need to have it explained, the information, and then others have to see, you know, go through it, actually do it, you know, physically. It might be the same requirement. So it's vital that you do things on the overhead to just make sure it's all sort of nailed down, you know, how we want to play.
Certainly, and it's like in any walk of life, like you have your different types of learners and what have you. How does it work for goalkeepers? Because I suppose you don't have much time to really drill much with them.
No, I mean, the great thing is hopefully I've seen these keepers prior, you know, over the season. What will happen, I will definitely get to try to see them at least two or three times. And again, I've got to say this, Richard, that is one position where we've been very, very lucky over the years, but it's becoming harder and harder to select goalkeepers at under 23 level in the National League, because there's not many that we can select from. And again, perhaps people don't realise that. If any, you know, going back, there's a young goalkeeper now playing at, I believe he's playing at Accrington, Nathan Baxter. And I thought, well, you know, he looks a good prospect. When I saw him, I didn't realise, but he was on loan from Chelsea. Yeah. So, you know, I think he was playing at the time, I believe he was playing at Woking at the time. Couldn't select him because he was on loan from Chelsea. He was a, you know, 19, 20 year old. So in the National League, the and below, the under 23 goalkeepers are not really, you know, a number of them out there playing. So it's a difficult position to select people. But we've had some top keepers over the years, and when they come to us, you know, for the game, we will go through, you know, not a great deal, but a lot of technical stuff. Just making sure, again, just getting them ticking over, just getting their confidence, making sure they're, you know, ready for the encounter that's ahead. And as I say, the other thing is I always talk to them, you know, about their games and what's needed in the game, you know, when we're in the hotel. So the mental side of the goalkeeper is vital, and the understanding between the coach and the keepers is a very important thing.
Why do you think it's the case being coming harder and harder to select under 23 goalkeepers in the National League?
Well, that's I get it, I understand it. Managers are under pressure in terms of it's a results business, we know that. And to go with a young goalkeeper sometimes is not always on their remit. You know, they you know, what I'm getting many, many times is he's not experienced enough. Well, the only way he's going to get experienced is by playing. But then come back to what we just said, it's, you know, goalkeepers, look, the position we know is a specialised position. I say this so much to people that I'm coaching. It's a specialised position. It needs specialised coaching and special understanding. And, you know, the goalkeeper is the one who's the fall guy. Goalkeepers will make mistakes. It's the nature of the position. But the best goalkeepers are the ones who make the fewest mistakes. So, you know, your question to me is, I believe the managers, I wouldn't say not trusting young goalkeepers, but they'd rather go with someone who's already established, already, you know, and experienced in the game. And that seems to be their pick on you know, most occasions for me.
Yeah, so when you're looking for a goalkeeper and you do find one, it can be a potential gem, particularly if he's playing at such a young age.
Well, exactly. Yeah, they will be the gem, and you know, as I said, it's something that you know, managers will look for. But you know, we see it at the top level, see it all the way down. You see it all the way down the pyramid. If I said to you, you tell me young goalkeepers that are playing in the Premiership at the moment, you wouldn't say there's many young goalkeepers really playing at 19, 20, 21 years of age, really, in the Premiership. So it does filter all the way down. But the only way they're going to get experience is by playing. You can train, as, you know, till you're blue in the face, for a better term. But there's nothing better than playing, because that's when you learn. You know, you might not be in the game. When I say you might not be in the game, you know, you're getting me going on my coaching front here. But you might be out of the game in terms of making saves, making decisions. But when you are called upon, that's when, you know, you've got to make them. You've got to make the right call, the right decision, the right technique. But that all comes down to reading the game, and the only way you can get to read the game is by playing the game.
Certainly, and you touched on the amount of specialist work you do with goalkeepers, and continued on a bit in that last question. What sort of specialised work do you do with the goalkeepers leading up to the game?
Well, any goalkeeper that I'm coaching, as I say, whether it's with the England Seas or whatever, any keepers, I've been working with various clubs as well, but you know, I make sure that they are, I'll go back to what I said, mentally strong, confidence is sky high, and I'm a massive believer in working on sound technique and sound decisions. and making sure we go through. I'm not a coach that is, yeah, of course, fitness is a massive part of goalkeeping. You've got to have flexibility, you've got to have agility, you've got to have strength and power. But when I'm working my goalkeepers, I want them to make sure that they are sound in everything they do. Everything they make, they do, it's got to be done to a high spec. You know, it could be something that's such a simple thing to deal with, but it's got to be done well. Because the simple things have got to be they've got to be saved 10 out of 10 times, all the time. The great saves will look after themselves. So I will, you know, I go through on working with their feet, making sure that they're very comfortable with the ball, with the back pass, dealing with things there that come back at different heights, different pace, different speeds, different handling techniques, different diving techniques, taking crosses, and, you know, just going through the whole remit of what a goalkeeper needs to do. In terms of, you know, what we do on a daily basis, or when I'm working with clubs, as I say, you're trying to go through every sort of aspect of the goalkeeping remit, you know, dealing with the ball with their feet, making sure they're sound technique with every eventuality that they're going to use, dealing with crosses, do they catch, do they punch, starting positions, you know, everything that's needed within the game. As I keep saying, I'm a massive one on working on sound technique and sound decision making. You know, we've mentioned about the fitness, we've mentioned about the power, strength and agility. Of course, they're a vital part of the ingredient of any goalkeeper. But, you know, I say to many, many people, until you played in goal, Richard, I don't think you can get a grasp of the position, what's needed in the position and what's necessary.
Yeah, certainly. I don't know, very limited training I had, it was years and years ago, but there's still bits that you can still remember. But as you say, it's very much specialised. And do you think clubs, in particular like in the National League, should have like a specialist goalkeeper training to work one-on-one with the goalkeepers? Because you see, the lower you drop down, you should see your striker kicking the ball at a goalkeeper a few times before kick-off.
Well, you've just called it exactly what goes on, you know, exactly that, where a lot of the time there is just someone, you know, kicking a ball at the keeper, which is not good enough. It's just not good enough. There is people in place now. There's no doubt about that. In the National League and down, there is people in place who are, you know, doing goalkeeping coaching. What I go back to is, what is a goalkeeping coach? A goalkeeping coach is someone who can have that sort of a rapport with their goalkeepers. It's vital that they're there. They're a sounding board. So, yeah, it's there isn't a number of goalkeeping coaches in and around the National League now. And they know what their goalkeepers need. They know how to get their goalkeepers ready. And it's a vital, vital part. I say to people, Richard, the goalkeeping position, if you've got a decent goalkeeper, a good goalkeeper, you usually have a successful team. You know, any team that's won things or been successful, do it with a good goalkeeper. So, yeah, there's clubs are realising how important it is that they get a goalkeeping coach in to work with their keeper. Not just to work with their keeper, to work with the keepers, the young goalkeepers coming through, but also, I say, working with the team, you know, working with the back four, what's necessary. There might be your keepers coming for a cross. What do the other players do as he's taking that cross? Are they in a position of readiness to receive the ball off them? Are they covering the keeper in shots that are going in? Are you defenders, like, hopefully looking for any rebounds off your keepers and realising that it might come off their keeper? So I think it's important that a goalkeeping coach has that rapport with not just the keeper, but with the team as well.
It's interesting. I've never actually thought of it in that sort of way, because like in American football, you have the offence and the defence coach. So do you think it's become more evolved to being like a defensive coach, not only just working with goalkeepers, but you say the back four?
Oh, yeah. As I said, if you've got the know-how about it, I always say your back four, your defensive unit and your keeper are a group within the team. There's no doubt about it. You watch how many teams come off when they get a clean sheet. The back four, back five or back three and the keeper, they're delighted because they feel they've done their job. You keep a clean sheet, you're not going to lose many games, are you? You know, it's as simple as that. It makes sense. So I the more I've gone into the position of goalkeeping coach, the more I've worked with my defensive group, my defensive players. You know, I will go round, and I say it quietly, but I go round in the changing room when I've been doing the England C side. I say, look, make sure you follow things in on my keeper. He may make a great save, but you see how many forwards follow in on things and they tap it in for a rebound. And you look at how many defenders sometimes are just ball watching. The ball comes in, it comes off the keeper, and they're ball watching. I say, look, get in, get back in, because if it does come off him, you get there first before the forward. And they look at me and they go, yeah, we'll do that. So sometimes you need to remind those people. It's the same with your keeper having a ball that's coming back for a back pass. Are your fullbacks ready to receive it? It might come on your right-hand side. Is your left fullback ready to receive it? Has he got himself out, you know, to a position to receive it, and or just dropped into a little bit of space to receive it off your keeper so we can start another attack? Because, again, you know, you look at your goalkeeper, last line of defence, first line of attack. So it's a vital, vital position.
I guess the outfielder players, particularly the defenders, they must like, you know, you're going around just giving them words of advice and just reminding them of their responsibilities.
Well, that's the word. It's reminding them. It's giving them little tips, just little snippets. But they're the things. I say, the more you're in football, the more you're involved in coaching, it's not the big things that trip you up. You know, anything that's big in front of you, let's be honest, if there was a great big, you know, pile of rubbish in front of you, that wouldn't trip you up, would it? Because you see it. It's the little thing in front. It might be a little bit of stone or something, and you can trip over that. It's the same with football. You know, it's not the big things that trip you up. It's the little details that make the biggest differences. And I'm massive on that, making sure you get the details right. You know, I say to my goalkeepers, I said, you look at a good painting, you look at a good picture. It's the details that make that. It's the details. So it's getting the details right in the goalkeeping position, working with your back line, making sure everything is covered for any eventuality. I'm a massive believer on making sure hindsight's a big thing. But if you've got things, I always say, foul to prepare, prepare to foul. Prepare well, you've got a chance to be successful.
Certainly, and being successful all comes on the football pitch. Just talk us through what a match day is like for the England C team. I know you've obviously mentioned about being at the hotel and the little light training session you have before the game and the meetings.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a massive event. It's a massive event. As I said, they go away with their international caps. You speak to any of the players when they get presented with their caps after the game, which we always try to do. So it's the build-up to the game is everyone, you know, is in their England tracksuit and shirts and things like that. Preparation is key, as I go back to that. Everything, every eventuality is covered. Their pre-match, their rest periods, their downtime. We go back to in terms of every, you know, even if you're on the bench, you've got a role to play. So everyone has a role to play, because at any given time, you could be called upon. And as I said, we try to put in place over not a great deal of time. We put a lot of things into place where they interview each other, the players get to know each other, because again, they're brought together from various clubs, and we try to gel them as a team as quickly as we can to rely on each other and make sure they are a team. When they go out on that field of play, they are ready and, you know, so enthusiastic to get a result for their team. But they're their teammates, so they've got to rely on them. So in those few days we're together, we really do, as I say, go back to the world, try to gel them in terms of relying on each other.
Is that an easy thing to do, try and get them to gel there quickly together? I suppose they must know each other from being on the pitch, even as opposition players in some regards.
Well, I wouldn't say it's an easy thing, but it's a vital thing that you get the right ingredients that they know. I mean, I go back to what I've just said, when Paul Fairclough's done a fantastic job as manager in terms of you know, doing a really thorough job in terms of knowing the players, and when they come to us, that they know what they've got to buy into. He does very, very well with that, and hopefully I assist him in that sort of role. but we've also got a terrific back team, a backroom team of a, you know, the physio, the sports scientist, the kit man, a doctor. You know, every eventuality or everything that the player hasn't got to worry about too much in terms of any organisation. What they've got to worry about is making sure they're there on time for meetings, that they're clear about instructions, what's needed for the game plan, and everything is in place for them to go and perform to their maximum.
With all this backroom staff, the tracksuits, the shirts, are they like the same sort of tracksuits and shirts that the full England team
exactly
wear?
Exactly. Everything is in place. As I said, all the kit, all the training kit, all the equipment, all the backup, as I said, the staff from the doctor, all the medical equipment, it's all there. And as I said, they're treated as highly as any international footballer could be treated in terms of what they are given. They're usually picked up in cars to get to the games, taken home after the games. And as I said, everything is in place for them. And I go back, you know, we're one of the only teams, I believe, that present their caps after the game. We tend to have a small sort of a meal after the game or reception. And we try as much as possible to engage their parents, their loved ones, to be there as well, to see them gain this international recognition.
Yeah. That's fantastic, particularly like getting the families and wives involved, particularly the like as memories, and it makes them strive to get into the next England C team if they're available.
Oh, exactly. You know, to have your family there watching, as I said. See, again, Rich, I don't think people always understand these lads who were selected. A lot of these lads we've selected have always had, I would say the majority of them, have had knockbacks, you know, across their career. They've been most probably with professional clubs where they've been released. I mean, I can look back on a number of players who have been in youth teams, in reserve teams, even knocked on the door and played in the first team at these professional clubs. But for one reason or another, they're a surplus to requirements. And it's been a journey. It's been a journey of discovery, a journey of going again. And there's been you know, players who haven't gone again. But these boys we've selected, they go again, and they're rewarded with international recognition. I'll go back to what we said at the start of this conversation. They get to play for England. It's been rubber stamped, and we've played in some wonderful locations. You know, been out to Moscow, played the Russian under-23s. I go back to a game, Richard. You know, I remember playing at Luton a number of years ago. And this is the sort of caliber of players they're playing against. We played Luton, we played Belgium. We won 1-0. We had a guy called Matthew Barnes Homer scored. Who did he score against in goal for Belgium? Courtois. He was playing in goal, and he was being marked by Toby Alderweireld, who's playing for Tottenham. So, and we won 1-0, so it just shows you the calibre of opposition we're up against.
That's fantastic. Particularly beating a side like Belgium, they've gone to great things. The two players you mentioned have gone to great things. Particularly as a non-league player, it inspires them to really push on to that next level then.
Oh, it does, exactly. They know, you know, that is exactly the point. It is the next level. You're challenged, you know, some players, they look at it and go, well, you know, the opposition we're playing against, they're challenging themselves as a player to sometimes have to deal with different problems, different, you know, setups for teams, the different way they play these foreign international teams. So it's a real challenge, and it's a great challenge for these players to come up against different opposition who are playing in a different way. And the big thing as well, when, and I mean this in a nice way, that they're speaking a different language on the pitch because they don't know perhaps what's being said. So it's a, you know, a real learning curve for these players to experience that.
Yeah, certainly, in particular, like you mentioned, the language and what have you, the learning, and if they move up into the higher echelons of football, you could potentially be coming up against players from these nations who don't necessarily speak the English as their first language.
Yeah, I mean, we went two or three seasons ago now. We played Turkey. We played them at Dartford. Now, don't sound a real big ground, but it was absolutely ram full. It was full up. It was a small national league ground, but you know, 4,000 or 5,000 people there, and all behind the goal was Turkish fans with the flares and everything and the flags. And the centre forward for Turkey that night was Toskan, who's gone on to Everton. What are they signing for? 20 million? He was playing, you know. So you're dead right. It's to come up against this opposition. Well, it's what a great thing that they can look back on in their career and say, you know, we played against players of that standard.
How does the venues of where games are going to be played get picked at? Because you've obviously played like at Luton, you played at Dartford, you had a game. Your last game was at Salford City, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, if we are playing home games, they try to very much embrace playing at various parts of the country. Not always in, you know, it might be in London, as you say, it might be up in Salford. You know, we've played at Shrewsbury before now, we've played at Chester, we've played at Woking, we've played at Aldershot. So in terms of what they're selected, Richard, is that they try to, spread it out where, you know, they believe fans could come and support it. And we try, we don't do it, that's not always the reason we do it, but if there is players selected in and around an area, we try to play in and around that area, you know, to give the fans a little bit of something they can, you know, to really aspire to, that their local players are playing for England.
I suppose it's a good incentive for people to go and watch. I always want you to come down to Stoke-on-Trent, where I'm based, because I would love to come and watch a game, an international game. That'd be fantastic. Probably not the best place to bring a team there down there at Stoke-on-Trent, where you've got some of the other areas.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that's an opinion. I think it's important that we do, come to various parts of the country to showboat what the team's all about, and people will see that it's an international side where they can support the lads from the National League down. And as I said, it's what's happening in the world at the moment with games. When we get supporters back, we hope this England C team will be something that people will come and support.
Yeah. You talk about going off to different parts of the UK. You also go off to various parts of the world. Have you been to Nepal, Bermuda? So what's that like, travelling out to there?
Well, the Nepal one unfortunately didn't materialise. That was something that was going to happen till COVID came in, and that was on the back burner. We was going to play in Nepal here at Aldershot, because they've got a big contingence of Nepalese sort of people. And then the flip side of that was we were going to go out to Nepal, but hopefully that still can materialise. But no, we've gone and played in. I remember playing the lads, and boy, Luke Berry scored for us, who's now applying his trade at Luton. We played in the King Abdullah Stadium in Jordan, and that was a fantastic. See, again, what this team does, it really shows a real. It highlights. We go out into schools. We go into, when we go to these places, local communities. When we played out in Jordan, we worked with some Syrian refugee children, and we had the UNICEF involved, the British Embassy was involved, and we, for one afternoon, worked with these young kids who had nothing, you know, and it was a great, great experience for all of us. And the players themselves, they just thought it was a great thing to do, that we was working with, you know, people of that sort of, who have got, you know, massive issues or problems to deal with in the world. And that's what this England C team does. It goes around and also is a really good ambassador for what England football's about.
We've gone up to about 40 minutes and we've touched bits and bobs on goalkeepers, but just going through some of the goalkeepers that you've been privileged to work with in this England C team, because you've had some fantastic names over the years.
Oh, without doubt. As I said, when I sit down and look at the keepers we've had, we started out, one of the first we had who's back in the Championship at the moment is David Stockdale. David Stockdale finished up, and he's our closest player, if you like, to go to nearly get a full international cap after playing for the England C side. He was playing at Darlington at the time and York City. And he came away to, we played in Italy, And he actually came on. He came on for about the last 20 minutes, and he replaced Nicky Ball. And Nicky Ball's had a great career, played at Brentford, Wickham. So he was another goalkeeper we had who's played championship football. We've had Swan Jalal, who's been playing, Paul Jones, who had a lot of games. We've had, in terms of other keepers at the moment, Ben Killip, who's playing at Hartlepool. As I said, we had another lad called Aaron Lee Barrett, who played in the Football League. I'm just sort of like, you know, trying to think the keepers, John Kennedy, who played, he had a lot of games. We've got Adam Bartlett, played a number of games. He finished up playing in the Football League. He was at Gateshead at the time, but finished up playing in the Football League. People have gone on to Matty Glennon, who was playing at Carlisle. He finished up, you know, being promoted with Carlisle and went and played in the Scottish Prem. As I said, there's just an abundance of Chrissy Will. Chrissy Will was a top goalkeeper who was playing at Yeovil and finished up playing at Leicester and was vying for the number one position with Kasper Schmeichel, you know, when I was in the Championship. As I said, there's a real array of excellent, excellent goalkeepers who I've been privileged to have worked with, coached with, and, you know, gone on to bigger and better things. So, you know, if I've left keepers out there, I apologise, because I'd have to go through my list again of, you know, but there's a number of keepers there of, you know, top, top keepers. But I would like to say, Rich, they're not just top keepers I've worked with, they're top lads, they're top individuals. That's always impressed me. And as I said, it's just a real privilege to work with them.
And it goes back to what you said right at the start of the podcast and halfway through. It really rubber stamps their career getting called up for England, the likes of Stockdale, what he's gone on to achieve.
Oh, exactly. You know, as I said, they see it, and they still see it as a massive honour. You know, I can't emphasise that enough. It's a massive honour, and it is the stepping stone of their career to give them that confidence, that credibility, you name it. Playing for England C is a massive thing.
I've spoke quite a lot about the England C team, the ins and outs of it. Let's talk a bit about your career. Okay, how did you start working for the England C team?
Well, as I said, you know, in terms of my own career, in terms of coaching, you know, my playing career was cut out a little bit, unfortunately. I was at Chelsea as a young keeper, and at 21 years of age, I was unfortunate to have a car crash, which put me out of action for 2 years, to be totally honest with you. And but I came back and played non-league football. I played at Walthamstow Avenue and various other non-league sides. And then just, you know, played and played. But at that stage, it was someone I can, you know, really credit for my rise in the coaching was Bob Wilson, the old Arsenal goalkeeper and the pundit, you know, for ITV and BBC. I wrote to Bob, and goalkeeping coaching wasn't something that was on the agenda. Wasn't on the, you know, people didn't have goalkeeping coaches then. Bob was someone I admired. And I wrote to him, and he invited me over. He's become a great friend of mine. And I got my coaching badges, got up took all my badges, and finished up being an A-licensed outfield coach and becoming an A-licensed goalkeeping coach. And at various clubs, I coached at Tottenham in the academy, I coached at Cat Palace in the academy, Leighton Orient, and then also at Dagenham and Redbridge. But at 36, I went out to America. I went out to America, became the head coach at the University of Alabama, which is a bit left field, for a better word. And it was a great opportunity to go out there when it was football was in its infancy. I didn't have the MLS, so I went out there and worked in a college scheme. Came back, and as I said, applied my trade at various clubs. Got to know Paul Fairclough over the years. And as I said, we've been together now for, 16, 17 years of coaching. So the goalkeeping position, as I said, it's a specialised position. I've said that numerous times. And as I said, I've been very, very fortunate to work within the FA structure of coaching for the London FA as well, delivering various courses of outfield and goalkeeping. As I said, it's been a journey I've been on which I've thoroughly enjoyed. And as I said, to coach for England has been the pinnacle of my career. And, you know, I'm very, very thankful. It's given me the opportunity to travel the world as well and work with great players, great coaches, and meet great people. So it's been something I, you know, I'm very, very thankful indeed.
What was it like working out in America at the University of Alabama?
Well, that's, as I said, that's a story in itself, Richard. One day I'm going to try to write a book about all these adventures and various places. But no, going out there, I mean, just a quickie, which might just give people a little bit of a laugh on the story. I mean, being out in Alabama, I've only been there about 3 weeks, walked out on the training field, spoke to the grounds person, and I said to the grounds person, look, you know, can you make sure you mark out all the pitch? Well, straight away, you don't say pitch. That's to do with baseball. Yeah. Pitch is baseball. No, it's a soccer field, you know, soccer field. So I've gone out this soccer field. I said, well, make sure we get the six-yard boxes. And I say this, you know, this is true to the point. I walked out, I said, make sure I've got my six-yard boxes. And in front of my goals, I had 2 6-yard boxes. And I mean 2 6-yard square boxes in front of the goal. So I thought to myself, I've got my work cut out here, but it was great. You know, I felt I was, for a better word, a pioneer to develop the game out there. We developed it. I made sure the local community got involved. And I always said to my players out there, whatever you do, you are going to be the next generation of coaches. You're the players at the moment, but you're going to be the next generation of coaches of America, of the game, you know, in America. And I've got to say, a number of those players I first worked with have gone on to coach, you know, high school out there or club, and been involved in the game. And all those players at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, keep in touch with me on a regular basis. And I'm proud of that legacy, to have seen that happen. And as I said, that's something. And we travelled all over the States. And again, there's a player we played against. I'm going on a bit here, but we played in St. Louis. I remember playing in St. Louis, and what happened, we've come up against Brian McBride, who finished up playing at Everton, playing at Fulham. He had a great career in the English game. And I remember playing over there, and he was a full international at the time because there was no NMS. So they were playing for their universities, but also international footballers. So yeah, big players, and a big country to explore.
Yeah, sounds fantastic, that, and I'm sure a lot of people would definitely love to hear more about your time out there. So if you are going around the book, I'll certainly implore you to write it. Just going back to the England C team, what's the future for the England C team then?
Well, we hope there is a future. I mean, that's the key. We hope there is a future. As I said, there's been it hasn't been curtailed, it's been suspended because of COVID, and there's no, you know, we're not being able to play any opposition. So we hope when things settle down and things get back to an evening keel or normality, whatever word people are using at the moment, we hope the team will regeneration or come back onto the playing field again. And we hope that's going to be something that's going to be sooner than later. When it may be next season, we'll take that being next season, but we hope that it's seen as a side that's going to be something of importance to get back on track.
Something I was meant to touch on earlier but completely forgot, particularly like with the way the media's gone, particularly BT Sport coming on, how vital is it having like BT Sport showing national league games for yourself, the Paul Fair Club, for the scouts just to sit down and be able to watch 90 minutes of a particular player, a goalkeeper, even if you've been off watching a different game?
Yeah, I think with the BT, fortunately, I've had the opportunity to summarise a few times on BT over the years, which was great. But I mean their coverage of National League football has just been it's been fantastic. It's been a real important coverage to have all that, and you're dead right, you know, to get that coverage week in, week out, every every game's covered. It's been a terrific thing for us to buy into seeing that coverage. So we'd like to say, well, I'd like to say a big thank you to the BT organisation that they're still covering the National League.
And hopefully, maybe one day the goal is to get a get England CT game shown live on BT Sport.
Well, that would be brilliant, wouldn't it, Richard? That would be what we've always hopefully strive for. And I'm sure if they saw it, they'd be pleased. They'd get a good following and good viewing figures to watch an England C international, depending on the opposition, of course. But if we could get one of the big countries to come and play us, it'd be a fantastic thing to have. With no doubt about that.
Just wanted to finish off by touching on the media coverage of the England team. You don't really see much. The non-league paper do a fantastic job. I know Matt Badcock's gone out for years following you here, there and everywhere, but you don't really, apart from that, you don't really get to see much, or is that starting to more develop with the likes of podcasts, websites, social media coming on?
Well, yeah, it could be and should be perhaps be more accessible and more coverage of it. But as I said, we don't always play a number of games each season. We might get, three games, perhaps four, depending. So there's not a lot of, there's not a load of games each season. But no, I mean, the coverage would be good. But, again, while we get the opportunity to big up one or two people, then I need to big up Matt Badcock at the non-league, because he's been brilliant, and David Emery at the non-league. Their coverage of the England C team has been, without exception, fantastic. So, their coverage is good. I think you're right. I think people are now getting, like you've got in touch with me. It's given an opportunity to hope people will realise what the team is and what they're about. And, the more sort of people are aware of the England C outfit, it can only be good for the team and everyone connected with it.
Certainly, and I echo what you say on the non-league paper. I think without them, I don't think I would have even heard of the England team until much more recently. Finish off on a couple of questions. We'd like to do a little quick fire round. So first of all, what's been your best moment being involved with the England C team?
Well, the best moment, I think, is first of all having the honour of representing your country, as a coach. That's been, for me, sometimes I sit back and have to pinch myself that I've been involved with that. So that's, for me, is the biggest thing. And, I'll go back to what I said earlier, to work with wonderful players, and not just wonderful players, but the honour to work alongside Paul Fairclough and everyone else connected with the England C, the backroom staff. For me, that's got to be right up there with everything I've achieved in football.
Yeah. Who's been the best player you've worked with, whether that be technically or just someone who's done everything you said right down to the T?
Well, as I said, I think we've mentioned goalkeepers. I want to mention one goalkeeper, and I mean this in a way that this young man is not with us anymore. Unfortunately, he lost his life. Was Dale Roberts, who was playing for Russian and Diamonds. He was someone who was someone I believe would have gone on to bigger and better things, but unfortunately didn't because of circumstances. But he was terrific. But I'll go back, to the players of David Stockdale, we mentioned, who's gone on. Steve Morrison's gone on. As I said, there's players now like Andre Gray playing at Watford. You look at the transfer fees for some of these players. Aidan Flint, who's playing at Cardiff, he's been, commanding big transfer fees. Ethan Pinnock, who's playing at Brentford. There's so many players. So when you say about, can I pick one out? I can't really pick one individual, but what I can do is say a number of players who have gone on. And if people want to do a bit of research, you could select a side who's nearly played 1 to 11 who have played in the Premiership. So there's players who have gone on to England C who have played in the Premiership. So to me, they're the ones who deserve the plaudits. But everybody who's played for England C have been an honour to work with.
Am I right in thinking, just deviating off slightly, you've had about 200 players you've gone on to make it professionally, whether that's in England or up in Scotland?
Oh, I believe there's even more than that, Richard. I believe there's even more than that. What do you class as successful? Well, as I said, if you go back into the professional game and command transfer fees, anyone who's gone and played in the professional game after playing for England C, whether it's from Division 2 up to the Premiership or in Scotland, it's, to me, is just a terrific thing. So, yeah, these players have gone on, and there's, as I said, it might be worth people that listen to this podcast to do a bit of research and see who's played for England C and gone on to bigger and better things, because there is a number, an absolute number. As I said, George Boyd is one who played at Stevenage, finished up playing for Scotland. Craig Mikhail-Smith finished up playing for Scotland. Sam Ricketts, there's a name, you know, in the past, who played 52 times for Wales. He started out at England C. Steve Morrison, England C. We still haven't got that. I mean, we called up Jamie Vardy, to be fair. We called up Jamie Vardy twice, and unfortunately he got injured both times when he was called up. But he was finished up being player of the year for the National League. You know, he's we can't really take the credit that he played for England C, although he was called up and gone on to play for England full international. But we've been close, and we're still looking for that golden nugget who's going to go and play full international football for England after they play for England C.
I can only imagine it's going to be any time soon, hopefully, with the way the game's been developed, and particularly players being able to go from the National League up into the Football League and ultimately the Premier League.
Yeah, exactly that. And that should be their aim. That should be their aim, that they can do it and they will do it. And as I said, let's hope the England C just give them that stepping stone, that little bit of confidence to say, you know what, we're good enough to go on to, you know, to bigger clubs and be a big player.
Yeah. And just talking about yourself personally, is there a particular goalkeeper or goalkeeper coach that you model yourself on, who you've worked with and taken lots of ideas from?
Well, I'll say, I alluded to Bob Wilson. I mean, he's been my yardstick in terms of goalkeeping coaching. But no, I've been very, very fortunate to have what I do call them friends now. I mean, my own goalkeeping school that I run for 20 odd years, we had some terrific keepers there, but people that used to come and help out in terms of giving their time. And we had David Seaman come over, I mean, the big man, you know, he come over and donned the gloves, donned the kit and joined in. You know, he was, to him to come and represent me and my goalkeeping school was a terrific thing. But I go back to Pat Jennings, is my hero, the big man, you know, playing 119 times. I mean, and it was one of the biggest thrills of my life that Pat Jennings knocked on the door when I was coaching at Tottenham, only with the young kids, and said, "Mick, can I come in and join in your session?" And he went on and played in the World Cup. I mean, it was an incredible thing. And Pat has become, I wouldn't say a personal friend, but a good friend of mine. And to have him as a friend, to see what he's achieved, say David Seaman, and it's a strange one, Rich. I've got David Seaman playing for England, Bob Wilson playing for Scotland, Neil Sullivan playing for Scotland, who come along to went on and played for Leeds and Tottenham, and he was one. As I said, Pat Jennings, Northern Ireland, and I've got the keeper I coached for many, many years at Dagenham Redbridge, Tony Roberts. Tony Roberts is the Welsh national team goalkeeping coach now, and he's a personal friend. I'll be having a chat with him this afternoon, Tony. So, yeah, all the home international keepers I've had a chance to call friends and colleagues, and so I've been very, very fortunate to work with those people closely, and it's been a real honour, no doubt.
And just finally, what advice would you give to any young budding goalkeeper who's listening to this and wanting to make that next step up in their careers?
I'm pleased you've asked me that question. I'm gonna just divert slightly. Yes, the goalkeeping themselves, but also goalkeeping coaches. Yeah. Young goalkeepers need to be given that opportunity to develop. It's so, so important. And how do you develop them? You develop them by giving them confidence. You develop them by giving them real praise. You develop them by making sure you work on every aspect of the game, because they're not going to get it right, you know, the first time round. making sure you persevere with certain situations to get the best out of them. And I say to goalkeeping coaches, work on their strengths, minimise their weaknesses, get those things that are not going so well, make sure they work on those things, but keep, you know, making sure that they come to every session enjoying, improving and learning. And if they enjoy something and learn and improve, they definitely will go away from every session with a smile on their face and saying, you know what, I've got something out of that. So, you know, yes, it's to the goalkeepers, but also to the goalkeeping coaches, make sure your session is something that's going to be of real benefit. It's not just putting a session on. Make sure it's something that's going to really develop you as a coach, but also develop the keepers you're working with. Because the goalkeeping position, as I say, I'll come back to it, it's specialised, it needs that specialised coaching, but it also needs that special understanding to get the best out of it, because it's a great position, and it's a great thing for any side to have a top keeper.
I think that's a perfect place to end the podcast on there, Mick. Mick, thank you very much for coming on and giving up a good hour of your time there for coming on and talking about the England C team.
Well, Richard, as I said, thank you for asking me. As I said, I hope you can tell by my enthusiasm and my passion for it. It's just great to be able to put things out there that's so vital to so many people.
Yeah, thank you. And if you want to follow the podcast, guys, you can follow us on Non-League Keeper, NONLGE Keeper. That's Non-League Keeper. And Mick, if people want to follow you and get in contact with you, where can they find yourself?
Yeah, they can get on Twitter, goalkeeping, would you believe, 111, and that's who I am. And just follow Mick Payne. And you know, again, Rich, if anyone wants to tweet me about anything that they want to discuss, and I can be a help, a resource, or someone they can ask, I'll only be too pleased to give them what I believe would be an answer that might help them, and I'll only be too pleased to do that.
Excellent. I think, as I say, that's a perfect place to end the podcast. So once again, thank you for coming on. Thank you to you guys who've listened in, and hopefully we'll speak to you again soon.